And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm pleased to welcome David Wiesner to the program today. David has a tremendously successful career as a picture book author and artist, having won 3 Caldecott medals. But today we'll be talking about his first foray into graphic novels. It's entitled Fish Girl, and he did the art and co-authored it with award-winning author and scholar Donenjo Napoli. David, you've had so much success in picture books. Why'd you decide to take on the graphic novel format?
Well, in a way, anybody who really knows my work would probably say, what took me so long? Comic books were a huge influence on me growing up. You know, I loved the stories as a kid, but really what I learned from comics was the language of comics, the visual language. And that was really the first place that I saw telling stories with pictures. It's an amazing language unto itself. And really, you know, I continue to come back to it. And I've adapted that language of the comics for my picture books, often simplifying it or using certain elements within the picture book format, but always taking parts of that, sometimes more, sometimes less, for the picture books. And ultimately, as I watched, it was very exciting to see graphic novels taking off the way they have been. You know, for the longest time, comic books couldn't get any respect. And then people, you know, looked again at that form and said, well, we don't have to do just superheroes. Although, again, I guess the superhero people also said, why don't we do superhero stuff differently and make them darker and edgier and all this stuff? But then other people started to say, you know, I can take that and tell stories that aren't fantasy-based, you know, reality-based stories. So it's been really exciting to watch that. And then really get accepted into the children's book field, particularly in the middle grade, whatever middle grade means these days. But really interesting work being done and kids really reading them. So it's become this huge growing part of the market. Basically, I had a story that wasn't a picture book, you know, which is what it always comes down to, is the story tells me what it wants to be. And, the imagery goes back to when I was in art school. This idea of the fish in the building, and that sort of coalesced into a building like a brownstone, sort of a row house, but without any of the other houses, just that one
three-story walk-up.
Yep, there you go. But filled with water and fish living in it. And I've been drawing that for years and years. And I tried several times to make a picture book using that idea, but it just never really came together. And the more I kept drawing, the bigger the pile of drawings got. And I had characters and I had a setting and I had all sorts of stuff going on. And eventually I looked at it and I went, wow, this is going to be my graphic novel. This is my chance to do a longer story. And that was pretty exciting.
How'd your publisher feel about that?
They were totally with it. It took me long enough to get to that point that it was already a growing part of the business. So I think creatively they were excited, but I think they were also happy to enter into that, you know, let me enter into that part of the growing movement, if you will. For me, in any book, the question is always, how long is it going to take me to write the story? I start with images and then I figure out the story. Occasionally, I wish more often, but occasionally it happens very quickly. Everything just seems to fall into place and I recognize what the story is. And then other times it's just real digging and nothing but sitting down and drawing and redrawing, and you keep going until all of a sudden you start to recognize something that's happening and pieces together into a story. It seems like a weird way to work, but that's the only way I know how to do it. And when I looked at this, I thought, oh, this could be a long process. And it coincided with just this thought of a number of years of, wouldn't it be interesting to work with someone? You know, I do all these by myself. So I've had a few collaborative experiences and it was really exciting, but I've never actually written a book with someone. And I called up Donenjo Napoli, who is a fabulous author and personal friend and doesn't live too far from me. And we've kind of talked over the years about, maybe she writes picture books, young adult, middle grade, the whole range, and talked about, well, maybe a picture book or something. But I suddenly thought, you know, I knew her work. She's written a book about mermaids. She knows the subject matter and I admire her writing. So I called up and I said, Donenjo, do you want to write a graphic novel with me? And she said, yeah. It was great. It was that easy.
Well, she's known for her mythology work and also her historical fiction work. Yeah. What was it like for her to work in a more kind of contemporary setting?
Oh, I think it was easy. She knows folklore and mythology and will always go back to the origins of any story that she's working with, finding the oldest version. You know, you might think, well, Hans Christian Andersen wrote, you know, Little Mermaid, but, you know, under sea folk stories goes back hundreds of years, you know, very far back. So she had, in fact, already explored that. And she writes very contemporary work, too, although it's that knowledge of that whole folklore mythology thing that was very appealing. We approached it as we're going to go back and forth between the words and the pictures throughout the process. It wasn't that let's write a text and then I'll just go make the pictures for it. Each informed the other throughout the process. Certainly, I knew as the art developed and the visuals, I would see things that would want to happen in the text. It always works out that way. And she's very open to that. And it was a really interesting process. You know, we looked at all my drawings, and it's often like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. It feels like these are certain ones, they're part of the same world, and maybe some of them aren't, but, you know, get from point A to B to C and connect these things was really interesting to do. And then eventually, Donna Jo went and wrote a draft of a story. And, you know, I said, just write a story like you write a story. And not try to go, you know, page one, panel one, this happens, you know, any of that kind of like screenplay type thing. Just write a story. And then we looked at that, which had incorporated all of, you know, my drawing and those ideas. And then I drew it out because we had to see what it was going to look like. And she'd never obviously made a graphic novel. And I had a pretty good idea what the thing was going to look like. But our editor also had never worked on one either. So, you know, there were enough people who kind of needed to see the shape of what this might look like. So, you know, I took 4 months and sat down and did a rough version of it, which came in at about 300 pages. It was fairly well realized in terms of the detail in it and the characters, and not too sketchy. I needed them to have a sense of what it was going to look like. The versions after that just got looser and looser because I didn't need all that information. I could tell what was happening in the pictures. I mean, that was great to see it all. And it very, all of a sudden, was like, well, you know, the time frame has to collapse. You know, it spread out over the whole course of a summer, and that was just way too long. And there were sequences that were really interesting, but they kind of dragged down the momentum of the story. And so actually seeing it in paper was great. Also, 300 pages was too many pages. I think it was too much for the story, but also the fact that I work in full color. I'm just better with color, and I need color. And
well, you're used to working with 40 pages, and you just kind of went nuts.
Well, that, you know, it's funny because the initial thought is, it's vast, it's endless, look at all these pages. By the end, we were fighting for every page, you know, just pulling stuff out. That was really interesting. But a lot of the graphic novels you'll see, particularly in the, you know, the, well, actually kids and adult, they're often done in one color. So you, whether it's a black line or a blue or a green or something like that, a darker color, but you also use the entire range of tonal range from like 0% to 100% of it. So at 100%, you have a really dark line, but you may use, you know, a 10%, a 20% here. So you can get a very wide tonal range, but it's just one color. So it's cheaper to print. Full color costs a lot more to print. So you can have a 320-page book cost the same amount to print as a 200-page book.
It probably changes the paper stock that you have to use for it, too, doesn't it?
Yes, I would say, actually, now thinking about it.
I think you have to use a shinier one for full color.
Well, it depends for the look you're going for. And there are variations from very matte to very glossy, and there's multiple ones in between. So we actually looked at several different stocks and finishes. But ultimately, the book had to have a price point that was, you know, if it was $35, you know, basically we're not going to sell many of the books. So that becomes a factor in that, finding what the right length was going to be. And then it was a matter of, you know, looking at it almost scene by scene. And this is where I think we're going to picture book. You've got 32 pages, you've got 40 pages. You have to be really clear, really concise, you know, pick those moments. There's not a lot of extraneous stuff that can happen there. I mean, that's a great, you know, approach to any kind of writing, is keep it clear and concise. So I did that, you know, really scene by scene. What's the essence of that scene? What do I really need to show? And how many pages will it take to do that and show it and get it across? So there was, you know, some massaging back and forth where certain sequences, you know, maybe got a little shorter because I was running out of pages for other things. And it really was at the end, it felt like almost like a picture book, in that I couldn't go any longer and I somehow still had to get, you know, material in there. And so it was fascinating. I had a great time just plotting the whole thing out, factoring the text and the size of the panels, not unlike my picture books. I mean, there's double page spreads, there's full single page images, and then lots of pages with multiple panels on them. I like that whole range of page design. It just makes for a more interesting reading experience than, you know, just endless pages of lots of panels. You can glaze over after a while. You know, we got through, we finally had this rough pencil version with all the text in place and where the word balloons would be and everything. And anyone who does these, I'm sure will say the same thing. It's, you then look at the whole thing and you go, now I have to make all this. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much of it that, whew, it's scary.
Now, your art style is realistic based.
Yeah.
And so what do you think that adds to the story?
I wanted to do it in a more representational way because I love the kind of fantasy, which is the way I approach my picture books, where the more it's based on reality, the fantastical element that you end in stands out even more, becomes more extraordinary when set in these very recognizable, ordinary circumstances. So in this book, the one thing that is fantastical, she's a mermaid. Everything else, you know, is there, is based on the house, the boardwalk, I was about to say the Jersey Shore, which is where I went for my reference material.
That was my guess on it, yeah. Too.
And I think just the sort of reality of the art throws the fantasy into greater relief to have that character in that environment. At least that's the way I've always approached it. I had to find a way to simplify that to a certain degree. I didn't paint the same way that I do my picture books, but I did use the same materials and work in basically the same, just slightly modified manner. So it is all watercolor.
What was your approach to the palette that you used?
Well, story tends to tell me where I'm going to go. And there's a lot of it takes place underwater. A lot of it's at night. So it went into these blues and greens, my favorite sorts of colors to work with. It's a fairly muted palette, except for some of the fish, you know, which are more tropical and stand out for the color. But a lot of that nighttime stuff contrasts with some of the beach, the sun and that. But a lot of that, again, is seen from inside this. You know, she lives in an aquarium, which is essentially a house, has been turned into an aquarium. And people come in and to see a show. They see the various fish. But, of course, the big attraction is the fish girl, you know. And there's a room that's got a big four-poster bed. And there's night tables and lamps and pictures on the wall. So the pitch is, you know, is she a fish? Is she a girl? What is she? You know, the strange fish girl who lives underwater. You know, her world is within this house. Even when she looks out the windows, she can see the ocean, but it's, you know, it's sort of a filmy kind of glass she's looking through. So we don't often see a lot of the really bright, sunny outside stuff. So whether it's not underwater, it's filtered through a haze of somewhat until she finally goes outside.
Now, do you have to develop those colors that represent the underwater behind glass and put those down, or do you put like a film on top of it that simulates that?
With watercolor, it can go either way. It can be a funny process, particularly the window stuff. You know, I can put down paint, but then I can take a brush, like an oil painting brush, a bristle brush. And if you lightly go over the paint and kind of lift it up, it'll take some of it out and leave a lot of it there, but it gets a foggy look to it, which is really nice. The other way to do it, and I probably did all of these, is to paint it and then lay over sort of washes of gray. I use watercolor is to put it down in layers, and each layer dries in between the next one. Since the paint's transparent, everything on the paper, you know, when you put another layer over it, the color underneath affects what goes over the top. So you get a lot of very nice color mixing that's going on, but you can also almost obscure what's under there in a nice way, which works great for water and dirty windows.
Before even the title page, there are two illustrations. One is of presumably the sea, and in the waters are a bit choppy, and the sun is just above the horizon. We don't know if it's sunset or sunrise. And then the next page, partly cloudy skies, we don't see the sun. The seas are calmer, but we just see a little bit of land there at the horizon line. And I was just wondering what the effect was of those two images.
Yeah, well, in fact, the end of the book repeats that pattern going out, and it ends the same image as the first page, except it's now the sun going down, the moon, in fact, the sun has gone down. You know, the ocean is almost like a character in the story. It's this entity that's out there that is kind of calling her back to the sea. Her big decision is whether to remain with her human half or go back to the sea. And I think the ocean is kind of waiting for her to make that choice. And for me, it felt like the opening and closing were almost like we come in from out in the oceans to watch this little story unfold. And then when it's over, we just kind of pull back out to the sea as that is over. And, you know, maybe we'll come back in for another story somewhere else. But it felt like a really nice framing device to be able to come through those pages. I initially had about 10 pages of them. That was one of those places where I said, I guess I can't do that many pages. That's something I tend to do in all of my picture books, too, is there's a span of time, you know, and it often will open in the morning and close at night, or there's a time frame that almost a cycle that happens. And that was an element of what that was all about.
Now, you talked about this three-story walk-up earlier. Mm-hmm. It's Ocean Wonders in the book is the attraction on a boardwalk, presumably the Jersey Shore. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering how a building with that much heavy water in it could stand on top of the boardwalk.
Yeah. Well, so maybe her being a mermaid isn't the only fantastical thing that's happening there. You know, maybe he gutted the inside and, you know, sunk a foundation and built the walls with cement and just disguised it so they look like I'm making this up right now. Although I thought somebody would ask me that, and you're the first. Yeah, there's some structural things going on there that we can't fully see, I guess. It would weigh a ton. All the water in there would be just insanely heavy, but, you know.
And after the title page, we have shots of the exterior and then the interior of Ocean Wonders, and we see the guests and the inhabitants of the sea life that are in the tanks. And over on top of that, we have him off camera. We have this voice kind of describing, you know, stories about the sea and what's going on here. And then finally, it's the big reveal that it's Neptune who's welcoming everyone to Ocean Wonders. Why did you decide to have that kind of off-camera approach as you're giving a montage of sequences around the house?
Initially, we had started the story at the moment, in the big life-changing moment, Mira, as she is finally named, the fish girl. All she knows of the world is what she hears through Neptune, the proprietor and owner of the Ocean Wonders. And his act is that he's Neptune, you know, god of the sea.
Why Neptune and not Poseidon?
I'll have to ask Donna Jo. She went Neptune. I was always the Greek side, but we ended up with, I think probably because more people would know Neptune. If you go down to places like the Jersey Shore, it's Neptune everywhere. So that's probably was the first thing. And I remember as a kid not being able to know how to pronounce Poseidon and read it and go, how do you say that name? So there's probably an element of it was safer to go that way. But she actually thinks he is the real Neptune, and they live there because, you know, the humans have sort of hounded them out of the seas, and they're essentially in hiding. All she knows of the world is what he tells her. And the moment things change is when she's accidentally seen by another kid who's hiding behind one of the doors where she shouldn't be, another girl her own age, and they become friends, and that leads to her questioning her world and discovering the reality of it. Starting the story at their meeting was difficult, or I found it visually it would be hard because I now have to go back and explain what this place is, almost, you know, in flashback style, or stop the story and go, okay, right, the reader won't know what this is. We're going to have to go outside and show it to them and just do a lot of explaining. And I thought there was a better way to make that integral to the story without feeling like just a giant section of exposition that we had to kind of get out of the way. I liked that idea of us listening to Neptune's, you know, spiel he's putting on his show. So we start outside the building. We see the whole exterior, the boardwalk, people walking around out there. The next page, we move inside, you know, from, again, starting outside, moving through the door, And basically, he's giving a tour of the structure and telling us, the readers, what the reality of this is, what the world is we're about to enter. So it's actually worked into the story. And then the pictures take us through, show us the various fish that live there. And then finally, he gets to showing us the room where Fish Girl lives. And then, of course, he turns it back to make it all about himself and, you know, how he rules the waves and the lightning and the weather. And then it ends up with him pitching to sell T-shirts and things like that. And the dialogue up to that point is contained in boxes. And for people who know comics, you know, well, these semiotics things, boxes tend to contain thoughts, and word balloons are obviously the balloons with the little tails on them. And so we're reading that whole spiel through boxes, which is where the dialogue is. And there's one panel where suddenly Neptune, we assumed, has been saying all this, but both there's a word balloon, there's a box next to him, and a word balloon that's clearly coming from him. And they start saying the same thing, and then they change. And the one in the box suddenly goes, oh, wait, it's changed, it's different. And that thought continues discussing, you know, oh, he must need money if he's changing his routine. And, you know, the people come here and the fish aren't enough. They want to know all about this fish girl and who is this fish girl. And then you turn the page and we see her finally. And she says, I'm the fish girl. So it, in fact, she's been reciting his whole spiel because she knows it by heart and heard it so many times. So I like using that to give us the reader a tour of the environment and introduce us to the character. But it also kind of teaches you, for people who aren't necessarily fluent in that language, how to read it, that the thoughts are in the boxes and the balloons are the way speech is. And then, of course, her big moment is when she has no ability to speak until the very end, when she says her first words and suddenly she speaks for the first time in a word balloon.
Neptune's treatment of her kind of has all the hallmarks of an abusive relationship and gaslighting. And that's a pretty heavy trip for kids to read.
It is. And kids and adults so far, some people pick up on it and some people don't, which is interesting. But, you know, as we thought about the situation, you know, a mermaid in a house, an aquarium, a fish in an aquarium, you know, it may be a beautiful aquarium and have all sorts of, you know, coral and all seaweed and various things in it. But it is still a cage. You know, they're not in the ocean. They're not in a lake. They are essentially captive. And so a mermaid in that situation would also be captive. So there's certainly this dark element of it that for Neptune, she's his bread and butter. He can't actually let the world know she is a real mermaid because then, you know, the camera crews would be there and the scientists and everybody. So she has to play this funny game of pretending to be a fake mermaid, you know, showing a little bit of herself and stuff, but not enough to let people understand the real truth. You know, that act is what keeps them in business. And so it is to his advantage to keep her ignorant of the world. And it is in fact, you know, an abusive situation, which she ultimately has to find her way out of and reconcile. Yeah.
So the human girl that she becomes friends with gives her a name, and that really upsets Neptune because up to this point, we just know her as Fish Girl, and she has friends within the aquarium, okay. And she's very good friends with an octopus, but she calls it Octopus. And so all the sea life there has no personal name available to them. They're all known as their species or types.
Right, right. I liked that. I thought that was, rather than Bob the Octopus or whatever, that also kind of highlighted her situation of suddenly, you know, this move toward being human. She gets an actual human name. And the more human she gets, I mean, certainly late in the story, after she's gone outside and down to the boardwalk and mingled with people, when she comes back, the fish all swim away from her. I mean, they recognize she's moving to become something else when she doesn't fully realize it herself at that point. So it is a pretty big moment when she's actually given a name, because it's that coming out and getting legs is certainly a big move towards the human side. But I think the naming somehow confers on her a sense of identity, you know, different from the fish, and begins that break.
Is she actually communicating with the other sea life, or is she just intuiting?
It's a subtle sort of communication. We talked about how overt to make it. And I'm a big fan of the suggest and don't make it too. It's sort of like the relationship with the ocean. There's a suggestion, there's some communication going on, but it's not like they're directly just talking to each other. I think the octopus comes the closest to having some sort of real conversation. Although even then, it's almost, I mean, the octopus, I think, in a lot of ways, passive until the end, understands her, and she's picking up as much facial expression as you can get from an octopus, I guess, and reading things almost like body language and things like that, more so than there being a telepathic communication. It's not explained in great detail, which is my preference, is to keep it open to kind of however you want to read that.
And as we've learned over the past 10, 20 years, octopuses are such highly intelligent creatures.
Incredible. While I was working on this, I read Cy Montgomery's Soul of an Octopus, which is a fabulous book, and just the amazing intelligence of these creatures. One of the great things that they can do is change color based on their mood. And we talked about
chromatophores. Is that what they're called?
Yes, I believe that is it. And that would have been really cool to do, but that was one of those things that I thought might be visually confusing. Now, it could have come out and, I suppose, said there's only one octopus who lives in this aquarium, so that no matter when you saw the octopus, hopefully you'd realize it was the same octopus. But it's always a different color, or when it's now, you know, I chose the orange, the really rich orange color. Whenever you see even a tentacle of that, you know, there's the octopus. That's one of those things which is nice to be able to do, is to take that color, and that is now the signifier that always
your
lets you know.
Your leitmotif for
exactly. Tempting as it was to use the color change as an emotional thing, it would have taken more images to make sure you understood that. And there were a number of things like that where she, in the original version, it was like two sentences where she figures out how to lock the door of the house so it doesn't lock behind her, to flip the little switch. And I was like a page and a half trying to show all this with all these little panels. And it was like, forget it. She just says, I know how to do it. You know,
figuring out the buttons for the controls and everything.
Exactly. It was one of a number of things that color change for the octopus was visually would take up too much space to explain it, to make sure people got it. And I was happy with the single color, because it then becomes, you know, a stamped thing. That is octopus.
Early on, the big thing that the human girl tells Fish Girl, that in legends of mermaids, there are legends that they have legs inside their tails.
Yeah, so she doesn't even know. You know, obviously, there is a television in Neptune's office, which at one point when she gets out of the tank, there's a little picture of her, you know, watching something. So she hasn't seen The Little Mermaid or any of the other things like that. And just as she learns later, where Neptune sort of lets slip that her mother and mother's sisters all sang and they had voices, and she assumed she would never speak. And so there are these series of revelations that force her into action. You know, she's ultimately the one who changes her situation. You know, we didn't want to have, you know, the romance thing where the boy comes in or something and saves the day or that kind of thing. It had to be something from within herself that she, you know, was able to make this change. So each of these things that she learns about herself and what she is prompts her to the next bit of action, which in turn reveals even more. So again, another place where the visuals had to really get succinct, when she comes out and what happens when the legs are revealed. What is that? You know, initially it was a lot longer. It was a little more detailed and showing stuff, and it was taking up a lot of space, and it seemed unnecessary. That it just almost melts away in the end. It was the simplest way to just have it go away and not get too caught up in the transformation, tempting as it was. But that was one of those, this happens, so let's have it happen and not get too caught up in me trying to draw out a plausible reality. Her getting out of the tank too, initially had this, there was this a much bigger structure that she kind of climbs up, and they're fake rocks and, you know, a slide kind of a thing, and it was just too much. Now she just pulls herself up on the bars and flows herself over the top of the wall of the tank and out the other side.
Now, with this experience of making Fish Girl, do you think you're going to keep on with making graphic novels, or are you just going to let the project decide what it's going to be?
That ultimately is, I'm finishing, literally when I get home in a couple of days, I'll finish the last half of the last page of a picture book that will be out spring of 18. And then I have another picture book I'm going into. But just over the past, 6 to 8 months, there's another story I've sort of been thinking about that it's longer. It's not a picture book.
Is it a picture that has been haunting you as long as that
story? No, no. You know, this is interesting. Very different. It came out of thinking about a kid in a situation, and the story kind of grew around it. It's very different for me. This is something that I would label as much more of a traditional way a story comes together. It didn't come out of a visual thing, which is kind of exciting. I mean, that was, you know, it's a new wrinkle in the process. We'll see. I will do it differently. The art. I will try to find a way to do it quicker, but also, you know, stylistically and as a challenge, you know, a way to do something different, just because that's always a fun thing to do. I've done that. I've done the color, the full color paintings once. I'm open to exploring things like working with someone who does the color, or digital color maybe. You know, comic books are done that way. There's someone who draws everything in pencil, someone else who inks all the lines, someone else who does the color, and they're a letterer. And I would be open to a team approach, but we'll see. It's this big chunk of time, and I have picture books to get to, too. So I don't know. I mean, it's a good position to be in, trying to figure out how to do all the work that I would like to get to. But the experience of having done it once has whetted my appetite to do something longer again.
And maybe you can start winning different awards instead of taking the Caldecott from everybody else.
Well, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks. This has been great.
David Wiesner is the co-author of Fish Girl with Donna Jo Napoli. Fish Girl is published by Clarion Books. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.